Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 229 of the Fun with Cars Formula One podcast for coverage of the Chinese Grand Prix from Shanghai. I'm Robin Warner, and I am once again joined by the root and the route of all of England, Christopher Roche. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Robin. How you doing?
I'm just dandy. Today, we are going to cover the third round of the Formula One Championship. That was China. And we are also going to briefly discuss the third round of both IndyCar and IMSA championships. And those happened one day after the other in Long Beach, California. So it's going to be a fun day. If you want to check out the full race schedules for all four series that we covered, just go to funwithcars.com/schedules. That's funwithcars.com/schedules. Or if you go to Fun with Cars, there's a handy little link that says schedules right there at the top. Anyway, in China, what happened there? Well. It was Daniel Ricciardo for Red Bull Racing that won the race, did so decisively, I might add. Valtteri Bottas finished second in the Mercedes. Kimi Raikkonen was the top Ferrari in third. And Lewis Hamilton was in fourth. Max Verstappen, fifth. Nico Hülkenberg, sixth in the Renault. Seventh place went to Fernando Alonso. And eighth place, all the way down in eighth, was Sebastian Vettel in the Ferrari. Carlos Sainz in the second Renault was ninth. Kevin Magnussen was the top Haas in tenth. Esteban Ocon and Sergio Perez, 11th and 12th for Force India. And then it was the second McLaren of Stoffel Van Dorn in 13th. Oh, yeah, here we go again. 14th and 15th, Lance Stroll and Sergei Sirotkin for Williams. 16th was Marcus Ericsson for Sauber Ferrari, the lead Sauber Ferrari. So Williams beat a team. 17th was the second Haas of Romain Grosjean. 18th was Pierre Gasly for Scuderia Toro Rosso. Yes, I know. 19th, Charles Leclerc in the second Sauber. And Brendan Hartley did not finish in his Scuderia Toro Rosso. Okay, Chris, what say you about the Chinese Grand Prix?
Well, it was an astounding win by Daniel. Exciting race. Red Bull came good. And of the two drivers, both on soft tyres with the safety car, both potentially able to carve their way through the field. Identical equipment, identical tyres. We saw the driver that was able to keep his head and make a series of stunning passes and get the win, and a driver who made a series of stunning calamitous manoeuvres, got a 10-second penalty, ran off the road, and ended up fifth. So I think, Daniel staked his claim to be the lead driver at Red Bull.
Well, you know, I have to say, though, you know, the other driver, the second driver, the young driver, that is Max Verstappen, made every mistake that you mentioned and yet still finished well clear of the person that he earned that 10-second penalty with, Sebastian Vettel. So he was clearly quick. He was just a bit untethered from his parenting leash. He's just a touch unraveled.
Well, you know you haven't had a great race when even your dad says you need to think and work a little harder, right? I mean,
yeah, it's
he was quick to apologize to Vettel. The move on Hamilton was pretty desperate. It's the sort of move you do on the last lap when you got nothing to lose. He clearly had a faster car. So some strange driving by Verstappen, but I think what you have to say is what a brilliant move tactically by Red Bull. They were the third quickest team. They were clearly, not going to get on the podium. Safety car comes out. They roll the dice. They do a wonderful, they did it twice in the race actually, where they stopped both cars on the same lap, back to back stops.
They stacked them both times. Exactly right.
Stacked them both times, but executed it flawlessly both times to get both drivers through without any significant delay. And it paid off with a win. So genius move by Red Bull. Mercedes, on the other hand, looked extraordinarily flat-footed in a safety car period again. So second time in three races, leaving Hamilton floundering around on uncompetitive medium tyres as a sitting duck. essentially, I mean, I think, you know, you can excuse why Ferrari and Mercedes didn't pit Bottas and Vettel, because the safety car was pulled out at a time when the leaders had already passed. But, you know, for Raikkonen and Hamilton, Ferrari and Mercedes dropped the ball. And, I mean, I know we're jumping around a little bit, but Raikkonen's pit stop strategy, you could question all day long, actually. Ferrari basically left him out and hung him out to dry.
Yeah, that just shows how far down the pecking order Raikkonen is in Ferrari's mind. The fact that they were basically what turned out to be effectively sacrificing the win just so that Raikkonen defended Vettel's position. And then things like this happen and, you know, Ferrari has to pay for it.
But, you know, I mean, full credit to Daniel. He, you know, he wasn't having a great weekend. He had turbo failure in quali. Just before quali, after FP3.
Yeah, it was in practice, and he had to, they had to do what they said was, I think they said normally, it was either normally a three-hour job that they did in two, or normally a two-hour job that they did in one to replace the engine. And he got out in just enough time to get in qualifying and I think end up, what, sixth on the grid, was it?
I think so, yeah. So, you know, they did a good job, but it still looked like a pretty normal weekend for Ricciardo, outpaced by Verstappen again. Didn't look like it, you know, anything exciting was going on. He didn't light any fires during the early part of the race. But once he was on soft, he was unstoppable. And some of the passes, I mean, the pass on Hamilton at the end of the back straight, dive down the inside, perfectly clean, no lockup, superbly executed. And then the move on Bottas to take the lead at turn six, you know, I mean, it was a car's width space and he nailed it, right? I mean, Bottas gave him some room, but
it was a car's width space and a few millimeters.
Right. So superbly done, very clean, looked in complete control, set a series of fastest laps after he got the lead and won at a canter in the end. Just outstanding and great racing. I mean, it just shows that having the different compounds, and when you get different cars on different compounds out fairly close to each other, the race can come alive. Unfortunately, so often that doesn't really happen, but it did in China, and it rewarded us with a great race.
I think that Red Bull really, I mean, it was said multiple times, and it, in a way it's cliched, but I think that this is a good case where we can say this was truly a team effort the whole race weekend for Daniel Ricciardo. The struggle to get the engine replaced, just making it out in qualifying barely in time. Daniel Ricciardo keeping his wits about him to be clean enough to continue forward in qualifying, not try to do anything too daring and, you know, have a big off and end up, you know, being out in Q1. And then, you know, just as you say, he had a steady pace. He was the right amount of aggressive. And then once he got an opportunity, the team absolutely sprung on the opportunity in good stead. And then Daniel Ricciardo absolutely 100% capitalized. And to a certain extent, you could call it, there was some luck involved in that for the safety car to come out when it did. But luck is what you make of it. And Red Bull absolutely capitalized on that luck. So I think this is just a wonderful example of a team winning the race, because you can so clearly see the different strategy calls throughout the weekend culminating into the event we saw today. Or, I'm sorry, on Sunday. It's Tuesday.
But, you know, I really still don't understand why Mercedes elected not to choose Hamilton. You know, really, they had nothing to lose by pitting Hamilton. You know, you kind of wonder why Hamilton didn't think about just following Verstappen into the pits. But I guess if the Mercedes team just were completely unprepared for a tyre change, it would have probably ended up penalising him significantly. But he was extremely frustrated that they got completely outfoxed there. And I, you know, completely agree with him. It's just seems rather dim-witted, right? You've got one guy, you've got one of your drivers who's successfully performed an undercut and leading the race. So, okay, full marks for the Bottas strategy and the execution around the pit stops for Bottas to leapfrog Vettel. So, you know, Bottas was a little unlucky because he second weekend in a row, he was in a position to win. He did everything right this weekend, you could argue, out-qualified Hamilton, ran some great laps around his pit stop, got into the lead, was controlling the race, and was undone by a safety car. But, you know, Mercedes were completely, you know, they did nothing to try and find some pace for Hamilton. And they just basically let him sit there struggling on mediums. And it's a little sad to see the difference. You know, Mercedes were great, been a great team. They've won, you know, many championships recently. But when it comes to the racing edge and finding that last little, you know, nuance of how to get an edge in a race setting, they've been outwitted on numerous occasions by their closest rivals, Ferrari and Red Bull. This is just the latest example of it. They've got to sharpen up in that respect because the season's extremely tight. The car performances, there's nothing between them, really, between the Ferrari and Mercedes in race pace.
Yeah, well, that's true. And in championship as well, actually, Mercedes is in the lead of the Constructors' Championship by a single point right now, 85 to 84. I agree with you that Mercedes was definitely caught flat-footed. But I, you know, the only thing I'll say to that is you're absolutely right, and I think part of it is they've developed a strategy of caution and hedging because they always had the faster car, and in some cases by a comfortable margin. And last year, you could argue that the cars themselves were much closer in terms of competitiveness, but through a comedy of errors, Mercedes ran away with it last year. But, you know, they've developed a reason to think that caution is the correct way to go. But now that there are cars that have truly maybe not caught up, maybe have caught up and surpassed, it depends track to track. So it's a much tighter field and they can't be as cautious anymore. So that's going to take some unlearning of what the best methods are. And to be a little bit stereotypical, I imagine that the Germans are going to have a tiny touch, bit of a harder time being less cautious than some of the other guys. But that is a stereotype, and I'm certainly welcome to be proven wrong. But the other thing I'll say was...
Sorry, which Germans are those then? The Austrians that run the team or the British that engineer the car?
I did think of the fact that Toto was Austrian, and I do realize that much of the team is English, but you know, it's a German logo on the side of that car, so I'm gonna stick with that. But the other thing I want to say about it though is, you know, Lewis, he had reasonable race pace and there were opportunities that he could have potentially done better, but he was kind of off all weekend. He didn't set many quick times in Friday practice. He wasn't that strong in qualifying, as you said. Valtteri Bottas out-qualified him again. He wasn't in the zone this weekend. He was just a bit off.
I'm not sure I agree entirely with that. In FP1 and 2 on the Friday, he was going pretty quick, and I think he was quickest in both sessions. But then the temperatures cooled on Saturday. The car went away from him and he couldn't get it back and he wasn't comfortable. And as we've seen last season, when he's not happy with the car, Bottas has an opportunity to outperform him. And sure enough, that happened again in qualifying. And it seemed that Bottas's race pace was also better than Hamilton's. So certainly Saturday and Sunday, Hamilton wasn't there. And to be fair to him, he said after the race, yeah, I didn't show up. I guess he was apologizing through the first part of the race for the poor start he had, which wasn't a disaster, but he lost places. But then he spent the second half of the race just complaining to his strategists. So, yeah, it wasn't a happy weekend for him. He's struggling. He's got to correct it. And I think he's recognized that. And he's got to come back stronger to take the fight to Vettel. I mean, you know, he lucked out because he actually closed the gap to Vettel in the championship. But, you know, zero wins for the first three races. You could argue that Mercedes should have won two out of the first three. They haven't. And he hasn't driven well in the last two. So, yeah, he's got to fight back a little bit here. I mean, Ferrari's pace in quali, though, was staggering. Half a second clear of Mercedes. I mean, that was a shocker.
Yeah, no, that was quite good. And Raikkonen was strong all weekend. And you are correct. Lewis Hamilton was quickest Friday practice 1 and 2. I think what maybe I remembered incorrectly, but Raikkonen was only 7/1000ths slower than Lewis Hamilton in the second practice. So I think maybe I mistakenly thought that Ferrari was quicker. I think if you look at it holistically, though, and you can make a judgment about how much of it was luck and how much was strategy, but if you want to look at the big losers of the weekend, it was Ferrari. They were 1-2 going into...
Sorry, did you say Honda? Oh, we'll get that later, shall we?
Yeah, we'll get to that. Listen, last podcast was a lot of fun for me, so you're due. But,
back to your point about Ferrari.
They qualified first and second, and they finished third and eighth. That was absolutely unnecessary. They have a car that has very strong qualifying pace and competitive with the leaders' race pace. You know, I think race pace is pretty darn close between Mercedes and Ferrari, and Red Bull's just a little bit behind. But, you know, gosh, there's no reason why they shouldn't have been at least, you know, a double podium, I would think. You know, maybe Ricciardo was just on it, but what happened to Ferrari to me seems like a few critical mistakes.
Well, I would argue, I mean, I agree with you, to lock out the front row and then end up with third and eighth is a shocker. Now, obviously, there's mitigating circumstances for Vettel's eighth place, but let's just analyze the race prior to the safety car. So Vettel gets out in the front, right? He converts his pole position. I have to say, I thought his move on Raikkonen down the start-finish straight was outrageous. He pinched Raikkonen, squeezed him off the track until Raikkonen had to give him the corner, which,
Completely agree. Yeah. To a teammate,
yeah. The guy who supported him numerous times over the last season or so. Yeah, just squeeze him straight off the track. That's nice, Seb. And then, I can't remember. So Raikkonen then ends up in, what, fourth? I think he was fourth, right? Because he got pipped by Bottas and Verstappen from the start. Or was Raikkonen third and Verstappen fourth? I forget now. But, Verstappen was third on the first lap. So Raikkonen gets bumped down, but it's not a disaster. So then Vettel's controlling the pace. You think everything is looking good. He's going to do his pit stop, come out again in the lead. And he manages to get done by Bottas. And the shocking thing about that was Ferrari's pit stop itself. There wasn't any technical issues. The tyre change was reasonably quick. I mean, it wasn't as quick as Mercedes' 1.8 seconds, but it was still in the ballpark. But somewhere he lost 3 seconds. Now, obviously, you have Bottas has a lap on fresher tyres, which gives him a little bit of a pace advantage, but not 3 seconds worth. So somewhere Ferrari, whether it was the in-lap, out-lap combination of both, they made a, you know, big mistake to lose the lead. And then hanging Raikkonen out to dry, as we talked about earlier, was going to completely compromise his race if it hadn't been for the safety car. So they were going to get, second and maybe fourth or fifth at best. So from the front row to second and fourth is quite a drop, you know, and that's with a clean race. So, yeah, big mistake from Ferrari's strategy on Sunday in a number of different ways.
Well, and I think just generally speaking, it's a virus. It's a chronic disease to put so much emphasis on your lead driver to such a degree that you're going to have the other driver, who's just as quick in many circumstances, 1.5 seconds or more off his own pace because the tire is that ragged. This is his full of fuel race start tire that you have him running, 10, 11 laps extra beyond the usable value of that thing? I mean, it was just...
He went to midway.
Yeah.
Halfway through, 28 laps he did. Yeah, incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, so that to me was just... Go ahead.
But, I mean, as you said, Kimi's been on it so far. He was quicker in Australia and in Bahrain and China, even though he was out-qualified by Vettel, it wasn't by a whole lot. I mean, we're talking about a tenth or so. He has been quick so far this season. And to just still put all your eggs in the Vettel basket is just very short-sighted, I think. And as it showed in the race, you know, sometimes your lead driver's going to have a misfortune of some description or a DNF, and then you end up looking rather foolish, don't you? Because your other driver's already been compromised and is in a position to take advantage and still get the win for your team. What happened to the days when Ferrari used to, you know, prioritise the Constructors' Championship? Now it seems to be all about the driver. When did that occur? Was it the Schumacher era that introduced that?
I think it was the Schumacher era, and I know that Vettel very much wants to emulate Schumacher in every sense of the word. And you know, he obviously can't. He's not the equal of what Schumacher was, and that was a different era when Schumacher could overwhelm the rest of the team by a better budget and more testing than anybody else, so that the car was understood, and he had brains of Jean Todt and Ross Braun to help him as well. Nothing against Arriva Bene and current crew, but that was just a powerhouse. Again, we're going to go back to that term, powerhouse team that Schumacher had around him, Vettel less so. That whole bullying, I'm definitely number one in all circumstances, part of it is what he's holding on to, and it's getting to a point that it's hurting the team. I mean, you look at the results and you don't have to go any farther than that. That this was an obvious result of the team playing favorites much too far. But I do want to take a moment to talk about the incident itself between Verstappen and Vettel. It's pretty close to cut and dry, but not entirely. Vettel did run wide. Verstappen saw an opening. Verstappen took that opening. It actually wasn't an opening. So what's your take on it?
I think it's just, you know, he obviously had to make a decision in an extremely short period of time. And he obviously overestimated how much the Ferrari was going to run wide, because Vettel actually came back and almost clipped the late apex. So he wasn't so much in trouble that he was never going to make the corner, which is the only way the move would have come off. What Verstappen should have done is position the car to then get a run down the next mini straight, then onto the start-finish straight with the DRS to pass him, which he would have done comfortably around turn one, that Alonso showed even in a Renault-powered car, you could go around the outside of Vettel on turn one. So that's what he should have done. Unfortunately, you know, he's an instinctive racer. He saw a gap, even though it was there for a picosecond, and dove down the inside and you know, almost got away with it, right? I mean, the touch was very light. I'm not sure how much the Ferrari was actually damaged itself. I think the tyres were certainly damaged by the incident. The commentary team were talking about the effects of spinning up the tyres and taking some of the life out of them, which is what Vettel may have been struggling with. But I don't think the car was heavily damaged. I mean, they basically did a sort of nice pirouette together, didn't they? And but yeah, I mean, Verstappen's a real talent, and he made some clumsy manoeuvres, but you can forgive him a little bit for thinking, oh, here we go, he's made it nice and easy for me. But compared to the decisiveness of Ricciardo, he didn't seem to know where to use the pace that he had in the Red Bull on those soft tyres, whereas Ricciardo clearly understood exactly where he was going to make his move on each car. And that seemed to be the difference, whereas Verstappen was just sort of looking for the opening. Ricciardo was developing a plan and executed it flawlessly. So that's, you know, we'll see if that trend continues, because, as I said, Verstappen looked very, very clumsy. I mean, not just in that incident, but, you know, in his other moves. I mean, the Hamilton move was, again, you know, a crazy attempt.
Yeah, and that's coming off of the incident he had in the previous Grand Prix with Hamilton in Bahrain. So, yeah, clearly that's there. And I think that what you have with Ricciardo and Verstappen is the difference between championship-level driver and crazy natural talent that hasn't been fully developed yet. Verstappen had some brilliant races already. You know, the fact that he's a race winner at the age he is alone, clearly he has, it's not like he has no understanding of strategy and tactics. It's just that you get him riled up and it's easy for him to get flawed and make mistakes. Whereas with Ricciardo, he's more of a true seasoned championship level driver.
Yeah, I mean, Ricciardo, you know, he had a tough end to the 17 season, didn't he? He got overshadowed by Verstappen, but he's, He's out of contract at the end of the season for Red Bull, but I think there'll be a lot of team owners now looking to secure his autograph on a contract, whether it be at Mercedes or, you know, an extension at Red Bull, because there was a gulf in class there, as you said. I mean, he's a little bit further in the cycle of development, and he looked the complete accomplished race driver on Sunday afternoon. He had, you know, he took an opportunity with both hands and executed it perfectly and made it look easy just in some degree. So passing, you know, numerous world champions, you know, he had a tire advantage and he made it work. And that's what good drivers do, right? They take advantage of what they got. So, fair play to him. So let's talk about Honda.
We're not there yet. Okay. Fair to you. We'll rifle through this. I do want to quickly point out that we did have, again, several teams in the top 10. Renault had an excellent day to finish sixth, and McLaren to be solidly in the points again in seventh, and actually both Renaults in the top 10, and then also Haas Ferrari still showing that they're a solid team with Kevin Magnussen scoring a point. Force India just outside of those points. This is really the makings of a very strong mid-pack. And so I want to at least get 30 seconds to say bravo to Nico Hülkenberg. That's Hülkenberg. And along with McLaren, Renault, and Haas Ferrari, and Force India. Now, Williams is continuing the sad story, woe is me, kind of season.
I think it was better than Bahrain, right? Williams definitely had
better than Bahrain, but the results were quite literally the exact same, I'm pretty sure. And the difference was more cars were running behind them, and that was the difference. But yeah, okay. The Honda story, I'm trying to figure out what happened that Gasly was so strong the previous Grand Prix, and then they had the race result that they did here. They didn't change the engines to be slower again, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, that's a real anomaly, isn't it? Because they were really bad again. So the only DNF was an STR. It wasn't actually a Honda engine. It was put down as a gearbox problem. But yeah, they both, Hartley and Gasly, both looked pretty slow. They were running behind the Williams and the Alphas for a fair bit of the race. Obviously the Bahrain tracks, we know the STR chassis is very good. It was very, very good in Carlos Sainz's hands last season. It's a quick chassis. And, even with an underpowered engine, Gasly was able to be very effective with it. On a power track like China, it was shown to be, clearly deficient again. And they lack pace and they still seem to struggle with reliability. So I think we're going to have to, Gasly's performance in Bahrain was exceptional, so we have to look at more races to really fully understand whether or not Honda's, made a step this season or not. I think, for me, from races 1 and 3, the jury is still very much out on that one. Gasly also made an interesting comment. His weekend seemed to fall away. I guess he was expecting to be able to qualify 11th or 12th, but ended up much further down the order. And seemed to lose his way as the weekend wore on. So suggesting that, he really has to extract the absolute maximum out of the car and the tires to get himself up the order.
Sorry to interject here, Chris, but would you say that the cold weather may have adversely affected STR in the same way that it did Hamilton in the Mercedes? Maybe they were caught off guard by that.
Yeah, I think some of the teams are able to... I mean, Hamilton made an interesting comment. He was shocked at how the Ferrari is able to be so consistent. So whether it's hot, cold, or indifferent, whatever tyre, the Ferrari seems to be very pacey, whereas the Mercedes still seems to be much more sensitive, and that seems to be the case with some of the other teams. I mean, we did see that the Mercedes lacked pace on ultrasofts in pre-season testing, and that was what they were running in quali. So clearly, some of these tyre compounds suit some cars better than others. But it is fascinating, the Honda situation. And it will be, something that I'm sure we'll discuss more and more. But, they've got to be close to penalties now, haven't they? 3 races in? grid penalties for round four, do you think, in Baku?
Oh, boy. I am looking forward to the next Gasly top five where these tables are turned yet again.
So Williams, let's go back to Williams for a second, really quick.
Oh, all right. Well, quickly, though, we have more to talk about here. There is other racing again, sir.
Just 5 seconds. So I was actually surprised. Stroll was running 12th, actually, in the early part of the race. So, you know, you sort of think, well, that's not so bad. You know, with a couple of DNFs, you might get points. And yet they didn't take advantage of the safety car and ended up further down the field. So there's something very badly wrong at Williams at the moment. And it's as you said, it's sad to see. But their pace in China at least looked more respectable than it did in Bahrain. So I do have hope still, but not that much.
The next race is Azerbaijan, and I do believe Stroll was on the podium there last year. So maybe we can have a little bit of luck there. And I will say briefly, I am starting to wonder if Sergei Sorokin really was the correct choice. Maybe in the specific set of circumstances for whatever it was, Sorokin was able to outperform Robert Kubica, but I'm really struggling to see how Kubica would have had as lackluster a season thus far as Sorokin. You know, the fact that Stroll is your clear lead driver speaks volumes.
Well, maybe Williams would consider swapping them out if Sorokin doesn't up his pace. Or maybe they just need to keep the cash. I don't know. It's a tricky one, isn't it?
Well, yeah, either way. But as I said, there was other racing to talk about. IndyCar. It was the third round of IndyCar. And Chris, completely unabated, you said you need to start watching more racing. Did you watch any of the Long Beach Grand Prix, the IndyCar race?
No, I did not.
Oh, well, you missed. You missed yet another great race. This time it was won from pole position by Formula One seasoned veteran Alexander Rossi, who had 5 Grand Prix in the manor. He won the race from pole. He was the quickest guy all weekend. He was the one to beat all weekend. And in fact, no one beat him. In second place was the lead Penske of Willpower. And in third place was Ed Jones, young driver. And then rookie Zach Veach finished fourth. Another second-generation driver, Graham Rahal, he was fifth, just ahead of third-generation driver Marco Andretti. The second Penske was Joseph Newgarden in seventh. Tony Kanaan finished eighth. James Hinchcliffe of Dancing with the Stars fame finished ninth. And Charlie Kimball finished 10th. It was a great race. It was 85 laps that were quite hectic. And hats off to Alexander Rossi, who is now also leading the championship. So good on him. He is ahead of Joseph Newgarden, who is in second, trying to defend his title. And right now, Alexander's looking quite good. And a fun little fact about that, it was basically down to Joseph Newgarden and Alexander Rossi to get the Penske seat last year. Joseph Newgarden got the seat, and I can't blame Penske for taking him, and obviously he benefited from it right away with Joseph Newgarden winning the championship, but it's just showing, you know, Rossi is really upping the game of the Andretti Autosport team. That's Ryan Hunter-Reay, Marco Andretti, and Alexander Rossi, and it's just he's clearly showing real pace. And it was actually the day before at the exact same circuit that IMSA had their race. It's the full name of this race was the Bubba Burger Sports Car Grand Prix at Long Beach. Good for them. And it was won yet again by a Cadillac powered car I don't know. Is Yaho? It's JOAO Barbosa and Felipe Albuquerque, and they won in the prototype class ahead of Scott Sharp and Ryan Dial. Ryan Dial for sure is an open wheel guy. They were second in their Tequila Patron Nissan, and in third place was yet another Cadillac. This one, the Wayne Taylor Racing car with Ranger Vanderzande and Jordan Taylor, and in the GT Le Mans sports cars. It was a Corvette, the C7R, piloted by Oliver Gavin and Tommy Milner, took the class win. Second place and third place went to the four GTs run by Chip Ganassi. Second place, Richard Westbrook and Ryan Briscoe. Third place, Joey Hann and Dirk Mueller. So that was the other racing that you did not see. I will admit, I also did not see the IMSA race, but I heard good things. And what's fascinating about IMSA more than anything is there were two powerhouse teams that everyone was paying super close attention to. Yost Racing for Mazda and Team Penske for Acura. And they finished fourth and fifth. So they are getting better, but there's still quite a lot more teething issues with these new teams than everyone expected. So, but the IndyCar race, I'm telling you, Chris, now I'm going to start preaching to you. You should check these races out because we're now three races in a row that have all been interesting to see.
So excuse my skepticism, but the pole sitter won the race, but it was a great race. So if you know, Vettel had won from pole, everyone would have said, oh, yeah, it's another boring F1 race. But if that happens in IndyCar, was it actually a great race, Robert?
There was a lot of passing in a lot of places, sir. Kind sir.
Okay.
Listen, no, you're preaching to the choir. I defend Formula One when the pole sitter wins the race all the time. So you're making an argument with someone that agrees with you.
Okay. So I did read an interesting article by one of your competing magazines about the Dallara chassis. And one of the drivers did a performance review, which is pretty cool, actually. So
was that driver Joseph Newgarden?
Say the driver's name again. I didn't catch it.
Was the driver Joseph Newgarden, the one that did the, quote, performance review?
I think it was him. So
yes,
well worth a read.
So I am now keenly aware of the publication you're speaking of. So,
okay.
It's lovely for the IndyCar champion to say nice things about the IndyCar. But
right.
What's important is that the racing in all three events, including one oval, has been entertaining. It has been close. There has been passing. It's been worth watching. So I feel like I'm becoming an IndyCar cheerleader here, but I do genuinely feel that way.
I mean, one of the things they explained in the article is that they made a conscious decision to take downforce off of the wings, particularly the front wing.
Yeah, roughly 1,000 pounds.
And generate more downforce. Yeah, more downforce through the actual underfloor to make them less sensitive and able to follow each other more closely, which is a good move. And it sounds like, based on if you actually watch the races, it's resulting in better racing and something that maybe Mr. Brawn should consider strongly in terms of future rules development for F1, because that's really what we want to see. We want to see open wheel racing. We want to see close open wheel racing. And if you get within a second in dirty air and you can't follow somebody anymore, then it's not conducive to passing. So yeah, well done to IndyCar and to Dallara for figuring that one out.
So now I totally disagree with you. I think the only thing wrong with Formula One is the thickness of the halo. I think they should be twice as thick. I really get frustrated that from the overhead camera, I can still see some of the steering wheel and some of the front tire. I really want all that blocked because, you know, just it's like a good mystery novel that way. It's like, how did the wheels turn? What happened? Why is he over there now? So,
well, when's the closed cockpit going to be introduced for IndyCar? Because they're still running open wheel.
They're not talking about a full closed cockpit, but a windscreen, an idea that was abandoned by Formula One. But it's still going to be ultimately an open roof. So more of a target top, maybe we can say.
That's right. Dixon tested it, didn't he? And he reported it worked quite well. So when's that actually going to be stuck on the cars? Do we know?
I believe they were talking about 2019.
Oh, okay.
So they're a year behind Formula One in terms of implementation. But like I said, that gives Formula One the opportunity to double the thickness of the halo. I hear it should hold two buses, not just one. And... It's going to be way more better. But alas, we have to talk trivia.
Wait.
Last time round, I asked you the simple question, what brand of champagne is sprayed when it's actually champagne, not the rose water, on the podium, and what size of the bottle does each driver receive? You, sir, guessed Shandon, which, at least according to my information, is incorrect. And we had confirmation, at least in China, that it is Champagne Carbon. And that was a deal that was put together towards the end of the July of last year and first implemented at the Hungarian Grand Prix. And it is these carbon-bottled, it's like carbon-covering bottle of champagne by Champagne Carbon. And here's where I have to be a little bit cautious here, because according to my research, it is not a Jeroboam, like you suggested, but a Magnum, which is not as big. And here's the thing. Looking at the bottles that they had in China, they looked bigger than Magnum bottles to me. But just as a quick reference, there's the 750 milliliter bottle of champagne. Twice that is a Magnum. Twice of that, so four, is Jeroboam. But then you can keep going all the way to 40 bottles worth, which is a Melchizedek, which is a lot. It's probably about the size of a human being, that one. So anyway, it's not Shandon.
And how much does that cost typically?
The Magnum bottle of Champagne Carbon is $3,000.
Bargain. So here's the question for me, because I did pay attention to what champagne was being sprayed in China, and I realized I was wrong. So, but then we move swiftly on to the Shui escapade. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not particularly keen on drinking champagne out of my own sweaty shoe that I've been wearing for 2 hours. But bravo to the Red Bull guy who was up there. He decided to drink it out of Ricardo's shoe. I mean, I wouldn't be drinking out of someone else's sweaty shoe. So clearly, well, you know, euphoria can you know, cause you to make strange decisions.
For me, the thing more than anything else is you have to give your hats off to Daniel Ricciardo. He does new novel things to make it interesting, to keep the show going. We've been spraying champagne half-heartedly for, you know, over 50 years now, and Ricciardo brings his own fresh take to it, and I gotta love it. And the fact that he's known for something like that, I think is brilliant. I can't get enough of it. I applaud Daniel Ricciardo. He's the best one to win a race in terms of getting some fun out of the podium. So I have to say I dig it. But we have to move on. We have another trivia question, and I'll be interested to see what you have to say about this one. Okay.
How wrong I could get this one. Okay, let's find out.
The first Chinese Grand Prix was in 2004, which isn't all that long ago. But if you think about it, you know, we're approaching 15 years here. But when was and where was the first Grand Prix on the continent of Asia? That's the question that we will answer at the next Grand Prix podcast, which will not be the next podcast if everything goes well, because we have an off Formula One weekend. But Chris, do you have any insights on that one? Do you have any guesses?
Well, I'm going to say Japan is my guess, and I'd probably say Fuji, if you want to get specific, but I'm probably wrong, so don't take my advice. Google it.
Yeah, no, I'm going to answer this one right away. The first one was 1954 in Uzbekistan, and I thought everyone knew that. I thought that one was obvious. No, I'm kidding, of course. Right, the answer will be next time. But I want to let everyone know that the upcoming race schedule we have now, it is 2 weeks from the last race for Formula One in Azerbaijan. That race is on the 29th of April. And IndyCar is next weekend in Alabama at a place called Barber Motorsports Park, a place I've raced myself. It's a cool track. That's next week. The World Endurance Championship, its first round is still yet to come. That is the 5th of May. And IMSA is actually taking a couple weeks off. Their next race is a 2 hour and 40 minute event in Mid Ohio, and that is on the 6th of May. But that's what we have coming up for now. And I want to thank everybody for listening. Please do take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcast. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars, and check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. Chris, it's amazing to talk to you as always. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Robin, and everyone for listening.
I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.